WHUS Doors 91.7 FM.
You say you want a revolution. Well, you know, we all want to change the world. Tell me that it's evolution. Well, you know, we all want to change the world. But when you talk about destruction, don't you know that you can count me out?
Oh, I don't know. Well, how you doing out there? It is a couple of minutes after 6. This is WHUS 91.7 FM. Welcome to Naked Lunch Radio. I'm your host and producer, Dean Farrell, and I'll be on the air for the next hour, being all radical and subversive and stuff. Gonna start off this week, as I've been doing for the last few shows, with the Atheist Prayer. Our logic, which art in our heads, hallowed be thy wisdom. Thy enlightenment come, thy reasoned will be done, on earth as it actually is. Give us this day our daily needs, and guard us from our fallacies, as we correct those who indoctrinate their children. And lead us not into delusion, but deliver us from ignorance. For thine is the sanctity of thought, for the wonder, and all progress forever and ever. Hell yeah. Okay, this next article is from the Independent Media Center. It's a short piece titled, Direct Action Shuts Down Heavy Industry Projects in Iceland. Iceland has a reputation for clean energy and is usually the textbook example of clean, green geothermal energy. But recently, aluminum corporations Alcoa, Rio Tinto Alcon, and Century Aluminum are pushing for large-scale, intensive geothermal development to power new smelters on the subarctic island, destroying large tracts of silent, empty, undeveloped wilderness. And this is not enough. If all the heavy industry plans are executed, all major glacial rivers would also be dammed. Saving Iceland is holding its fourth direct action camp in the Icelandic wilderness. Over the last weeks, work on Century Aluminum's Helgavik smelter construction site was stopped for a day. Century's existing smelter, as well as a steel factory, were blockaded, holding up a shift change for several hours. A Reykjavik Energy geothermal drill site at Hellasheiti, by the way, I'm going to be guessing at the pronunciations of a lot of these Icelandic names, being built for Century, was completely shut down for a day as activists locked themselves to machines, climbed the drill, and occupied the power control room. And the national power company, Landsvirkjun, had its office invaded and its CEO, Fredrik Sofusen, had his home visited, saving Iceland nailed an eviction notice to his door. Landsvirkjun wants to remove farmers from the Thjorsa River Valley to build a number of dams to provide energy to a Rio Tinto Alcon smelter. In the north of Iceland, they're deep drilling geothermal boreholes for an Alcoa smelter in the north, affecting large tracts of wilderness. Outside Iceland, there were demonstrations at Icelandic embassies and consulates and at the Glencore, Alcoa, and Impregalo headquarters in Switzerland and Italy. So there you go, folks. You want to stop heavy industry projects in your neck of the woods? You need to put your asses on the line. You know, kind of like Judy Berry did years ago, and the end result of which was the timber industry having her blown up in her car. Okay, coming up next on Naked Lunch Radio, we're going to attack those slime bags from Arizona known as the McCains. Coming up first, the BuzzFlash GOP Hypocrite of the Week for August 22nd, Cindy McCain. In an attempt to come off as the all-American wife and mother, Cindy McCain is putting aside real family values. Cindy, or perhaps her handlers, has shown a pattern of deceit in her attempt to fulfill the role of Stepford wife in her husband's campaign. But her most recent fabrication is quite hurtful. Most recently, her oft-repeated assertion that she is the only child of her father, Jim Hensley, was proven untrue on all accounts. In fact, Cindy has three half-sisters. One, Kathleen Hensley Portalski, called into a program on National Public Radio this week to correct the reporter who repeated Cindy McCain's characterization of herself as an only child. Cindy's father was married to Mary Jean Parks, who gave birth to Portalski before the couple's divorce. Hensley then married Marguerite Johnson, who bore Cindy McCain 9 years later. Even before all this, Hensley already had a daughter named Dixie Bird by a third woman. In addition, Cindy is not the only child of her mother, who had another daughter before her marriage to Hensley. So, Cindy McCain is no one's only child. This isn't Cindy's first lie about her family woman credentials, just the most painful. Cindy also has been caught volunteering at least 3 original family recipes that were plagiarized word for word from the Food Network. And there was the plagiarism of the Hershey's cookie recipe for the July 2008 issue of Family Circle. Then on Wednesday, the Christian Science Monitor reported that Cindy McCain's touching story about having been convinced by Mother Teresa to bring 2 Bangladeshi children, one of whom became the McCain's adopted daughter Bridget, home to the States for medical treatment in 1991 was also a lie. In truth, Mother Teresa was in Mexico suffering from medical problems when Cindy was at the orphanage in Bangladesh. The McCain campaign has since revised the About Cindy McCain section of johnmccain.com. A common problem with politicians, and sometimes their wives, is that they try to be something they're not. We at BuzzFlash urge Cindy McCain to fess up. We don't care if she finds her recipes online. We don't care if it was not a proto-saintly intervention that convinced her to adopt the child. And we certainly don't care if she has siblings. There's only one step to coming clean, Cindy. Tell the truth. Because she's willing to lie about her family to come across as your average American wife and mother, we proudly present Cindy McCain with the BuzzFlash GOP Hypocrite of the Week Award. And now on to her husband. This article was printed earlier this week at truthdig.com. Written by Robert Shear, it's called McCain's Warped Worldview. The world, according to John McCain, is one in which America is triumphant at home and abroad, thanks to the Bush legacy, rolling to victory internationally and mastering its domestic economic problems. If Daily News, like reports of the 10 French soldiers killed by a resurgent Taliban in Afghanistan, and the U.S. government's imminent nationalization of much of the American mortgage lending industry, would seem to deny such a rosy scenario, that only shows that skeptics lack the courage that sustained John McCain as a prisoner of war in Vietnam. There you have it encapsulated, the McCain campaign for president, an irrational melange of patriotic swagger and blindness to reality that is proving disturbingly successful with uninformed voters. How else to explain the many millions of Americans who tell pollsters they prefer a continuation of Republican rule when so many of them are losing their homes to foreclosure and the nation is devastated by out-of-control military spending? The economy is in a downward spiral. The national debt is at an all-time high. The dollar is an international disgrace. And inflation in July had its steepest rise in 27 years, driven by oil prices 5 times higher than when George W. Bush invaded the nation with the world's 2nd largest petroleum reserves. While the oil-rich Middle Eastern nations we protect refuse to fully open the oil spigots as payback for our military efforts, McCain celebrates General David Petraeus as his number one hero for victory in Iraq. Aside from the reality that victory there is now defined as returning to the level of stability provided by Saddam Hussein, who the Bush administration now admits had nothing to do with the bin Laden-led terrorists, even that goal requires the cooperation of our former sworn enemies, Iran's Ayatollahs. Presumably, McCain envisions a more favorable outcome for Georgia, to which he would commit the unqualified support of the United States with his outrageously overreaching statement that, quote, "we are all Georgians," close quote. If Democratic presidential nominee Barack Obama had been in contact with the leader of a nation before and after that nation provoked a war, his campaign would be in a shambles. Not so McCain, who's acting as if he's already the elected commander-in-chief ensconced in a reconstituted neoconservative-dominated White House. By contrast, Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice has been reduced to a blustering bystander. That military victory in Iraq and any other trouble spot is the key selling point of the McCain campaign is odd, because McCain's credentials derive from participation in a war that resulted in the most ignominious defeat in U.S. history. How else to think of the loss of almost 59,000 Americans and 3.4 million Indochinese in a war that even McCain has long since not seriously tried to defend? Surely McCain accepted the notion that a Communist Party-run Vietnam was compatible with U.S. security interests when he, along with Senator John Kerry, led the fight for U.S. recognition of Vietnam. Wouldn't it have been grand if McCain, who made his own pilgrimage of reconciliation to Hanoi, would have drawn the proper lesson from that sad chapter in American history, that victory isn't everything it's cracked up to be? Or by extension, from the recent Olympic festivities in Still Red China, where Bush was photographed quite happily near portraits of the once dreaded Chairman Mao, whom U.S. propaganda had long described, quite erroneously, as chief sponsor of the Vietnamese communists. We are reminded of how brilliant Richard Nixon was in rejecting the neoconservative addiction to the Cold War that McCain embraces, when the late Republican president traveled to Beijing to make peace with the man previously depicted as the bloodiest of communist dictators. It turns out the various communist movements were nationalist above all else, and when we lost in Vietnam, the result was not attacks on the United States, but a war between China and Vietnam. The lesson McCain should have learned is that the world is a complex place, that today's enemies may be tomorrow's negotiating partners, as Obama has at times dared to suggest, and that the neoconservative idea of a Pax Americana is a dangerous fantasy, and a costly one at that. Not only in lost lives and blowbacks from the regions we destabilize, but also in the billions of dollars that American taxpayers must waste. Thanks to the absurdly misdirected war on terrorism that McCain so enthusiastically supports, we spend more annually in inflation-adjusted dollars on the military than at any time since World War II, even more so than during the Korean and Vietnam Wars. Vote for McCain and forget about funding to solve the Social Security, Medicare, and subprime mortgage disasters, or for anything else that would truly make America stronger. Robert Scheer is author of a new book, The Pornography of Power, How Defense Hawks Hijacked 9/11 and Weakened America. It's coming up on 14 minutes after 6. My name is Dean Farrell. The show is called Naked Lunch Radio, and it airs Saturday evenings from 6 to 7 on Yukon's Radio for the People, 91.7. WHUS.
All the candidates have their campaign theme songs, right? And you know, Johnny B. Good, John McCain's theme, not working for him. Johnny B. Good, I don't think that's, you know, because when you see him, you want to hear that Keystone Cops music. Because he's moving a little too fast, a little too jerky, he's in black and white. And people make a big deal about his age, right? You know, but he's a bedrock conservative who actually lived in bedrock. So chalk that up to authenticity.
Now we know he's the GOP nominee, 'cause he beat Giuliani and Romney. When he wrote his obit, he was too tough to quit, and like the phoenix rose again. The man, the myth, the McCain. His demeanor is that of a maverick. His complexion is like a cadaveric. With the wind in his head, like a loaf of white bread, he always goes against the grain. The man, the myth, the McCain. He could probably quote Deuteronomy, the man, but he can't understand the economy. Who can? In his prime, in the pink, he knew Moses, I think. The two of them worked out with Jack LaLanne. The man, the myth, the McCain. He says we'll be in Iraq for a century, till the troops are decrepit and dentury. And we've won at all costs, like the fact that we lost, and then he'll say we must remain. The man, the man, the man. The military man with the aerial plan. For Iran, the guy among guys who's large for his size, the pilot who flies off the handle of a myth. A lot of conservatives won't have a thing to do with the word Smith. On the straight, talk express, talking straight, more or less, full of vinegar and piff. That's piff. He's got all the George Bush sensibilities, even though Bush himself makes him ill at ease. Wants our grandkids to pay for a tax cut today. It's another shock and awe campaign. He keeps his special interest on the plane. He will not be afraid of death and pain. The Macbeth, no, the man, the myth, the McCain. His middle name is not Hussein.
Roy Zimmerman on WHUS, the man, the myth, the McCain. It's 17 after 6. This is Dean Farrell with you for about another 43 minutes of Naked Lunch Radio here on WHUS. And I also wanted to remind you that podcasts of the show are now available at radioforall.net. That's radio, the numeral 4, all.net. Just go there, type Naked Lunch Radio into the search engine, and you'll find some shows. All right, this next article comes certainly not from the alternative media. It actually comes from the Associated Press. It was written by Sharon Themer and Troy Thibodeau, and it's called Take the Cash, Ask Questions Later. Neither Barack Obama nor John McCain has consistently followed the government's instructions for keeping prohibited foreign money out of their presidential campaigns, and some of that banned money has slipped into Obama's campaign. During interviews with 123 donors in 11 countries, the Associated Press found contributions Obama accepted from at least three foreigners. Just five of the donors checked, three for Obama and two for McCain, said the campaigns asked to see copies of their current U.S. passports as instructed by the Federal Election Commission to avoid legal problems. Obama's campaign said it would refund the money to the foreign donors the AP identified. One donor, Tom Sanderson of Canada, made clear that his $500 contribution came from a foreign source. He included a note that said, "I am not an American citizen." Obama's campaign took the money anyway, even publishing Sanderson's cautionary statement about his citizenship in its official finance reports. Democratic hopeful Obama and Republican rival McCain portray themselves as meticulously abiding by campaign finance laws. But the fundraising review of hundreds of thousands of donations involving AP bureaus around the globe found clear evidence that both campaigns took money first and asked questions later, if ever. Shining a light on a weakness in the nation's campaign finance laws, the review turned up a smattering of illegal foreign donations to Obama, as well as missing details from both Obama and McCain in federal paperwork the law requires. Only American citizens or green card holders are legally permitted to give campaigns money, a longtime ban intended to protect U.S. elections from foreign meddling and influence. The Federal Election Commission instructs that candidates asked to see an overseas donor's current U.S. passport considered the strongest safeguard against illegal foreign money. Screening donors can be a daunting task in a presidential race, especially one with record sums and millions of dollars coming in over the internet. Obama has raised at least $2 million abroad, far more than McCain's total of at least $229,000, according to the AP's review of campaign finance records. The amount reported flowing in from outside the U.S. is a small percentage of the roughly $390 million raised so far by Obama and the $167 million by McCain. But few contributors contacted by the AP said the campaigns asked to see their passports. "I donated to the Obama campaign because I was so excited and thrilled to hear him speak," said Sanderson, a property manager in Calgary. "I like what he says, and I like what he represents, and it's a world stage today for any political leader." Sanderson said he donated money using Obama's website and doesn't remember checking a box certifying that he was a U.S. citizen, instead noting next to his address that he was not. After the AP contacted Sanderson by phone, he asked the campaign for a refund and said, "It was an error of me to give the donation, and it was an error that it was accepted." A spokesman for Obama, Ben LaBolt, said, "Campaign workers consistently review our procedures to make sure that we are taking every reasonable step to ensure that the contributions we receive are appropriate and follow FEC guidelines, and we will do so again in light of this new information." McCain's campaign said it was impractical to ask internet contributors for copies of their passports. Spokesman Brian Rogers said, We're always looking for ways to best comply with all provisions of campaign finance regulations, and obviously take swift action anytime flags are raised regarding potentially problematic campaign contributions. The AP analyzed 1.27 million campaign contributions to Obama and McCain to identify 6,948 contributions from people who appeared to live outside the U.S. and who were obviously not in the United States military. The AP contacted 123 donors in Australia, Canada, France, Germany, Hong Kong, Israel, Italy, the Netherlands, South Africa, Spain, and Switzerland, and interviewed them about their citizenship and donations. Obama has far more overseas donors than McCain, and that was reflected in the number of interviews. The AP was able to reach 116 Obama supporters, 6 McCain backers, and 1 donor who gave to both. Australian Richard Waters gave Obama's campaign $1,000 over the internet, entering a fake U.S. passport number, a random jumble of numbers and letters, so the site would take his money. He said he also checked a box stating that he was an American living overseas because, quote, I could see it wasn't going anywhere if I didn't do that, close quote. Waters was surprised when a reporter told him it was illegal for foreigners to donate to U.S. presidential campaigns, but he said he was still glad he gave. I wouldn't give up because I believe in the man, I really do, said Waters, 76, of Sydney, a stock market trader. Maybe I just feel he can put a smile back on the face of the world. Swiss citizen, I'm going to guess at the pronunciation here, Gilles Masamba gave Obama at least $436 and received campaign souvenirs. He said the campaign didn't ask whether he was a U.S. citizen. Just 3 donors to Obama and 2 for McCain told the AP the campaigns asked to see their passports. One Obama donor in France was asked to show her U.S. driver's license at a fundraising event. Others said if they did anything, they checked a box on the campaign's website affirming they were U.S. citizens or were asked to provide their passport numbers or both. A spokesman for the FEC, Bob Biersack, said it was prudent for the campaigns to ask online donors to check a box confirming they're U.S. citizens, but obtaining copies of U.S. passports from overseas donors is the only protection against enforcement action. In dozens of instances, the AP could not determine whether donors had foreign addresses since their addresses were missing from campaign finance reports. Other key information also was missing. McCain and Obama each omitted information identifying the employers for at least 10,000 contributions in their most recent donor data. In most cases, the campaigns appear to have asked supporters to provide those details. The ramifications of accepting foreign money can vary from political embarrassment to federal investigations. The last major foreign money scandal, a 1996 Democratic case involving Asian money and the Clinton-Gore re-election effort, resulted in a record FEC fine totaling $719,000 and probation for some of those involved. Sometimes the foreign connection comes from who collects the money rather than who donates it. McCain's campaign announced this month it will return $50,000 solicited by a foreigner and business partner of a McCain volunteer fundraiser in Florida. The candidates are supposed to disclose detailed information about donors who give $200 or more, including their addresses, employers, and occupations. At a minimum, if donors give more than $50, the candidates are expected to record their names. No donor names appeared in Obama's campaign finance reports for a handful of donations over $50. In dozens of cases, there were names but no addresses. Anonymous, 999 Anonymous Street, XX, or Info Requested are listed for roughly 200 donations to McCain. The requirement to include employers is intended to let the public and news media see who is giving help and help identify favors that donors or their employers may receive. The FEC expects campaigns to follow up with donors to seek missing information, but they do not have to try very hard. One attempt, such as a postcard sent to the contributor's address, is considered due diligence under fundraising rules. In Canada, Sanderson left a message with Obama's campaign and sent an email after learning that his donation was illegal. He said he hoped his contribution wouldn't rustle any feathers. Sanderson considered a mischievous move to neutralize the political value his donation might have, but in the end, he just asked for a refund. I was going to donate to McCain last night, Sanderson said, but my wife talked me out of it. And once again, that article came from the Associated Press. It was called Take the Cash, Ask Questions Later. It's 6:26. This is Dean Farrell. You're listening to Naked Lunch Radio on WHUS. I think right now we're going to take a break for 5 minutes to listen to this week's edition of Media Minutes from the good folks at Free Press.
Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news related to media and democracy. I'm Stevie Converse.
And I'm Candace Clement.
Dr. Susan Lin is a child psychotherapist who directs the Campaign for a Commercial-Free Childhood. Her work focuses on the need to protect children from the relentless onslaught of marketing and advertising.
Democracy thrives when there's a population of citizens who can think creatively, who can engage in critical thinking, who aren't totally blindsided and susceptible to hype.
Lynn's latest book, The Case for Make-Believe, Saving Play in a Commercialized World, draws on her 30 years of experience working with children. Lynn says that commercialized culture actually prevents children from playing and using their imaginations.
We've reached a point in society where nurturing creative play has actually become countercultural. And in large part, that's because it's a threat to corporate profits. Children who play creatively don't need as many of the things that corporations sell.
Children are bombarded with advertising for toys that are often linked to movies and TV shows. And toys now are often embedded with computer chips so that simply pressing a button makes the toy jump or dance or talk or sing.
But the toys are actually having more fun and engaged in more self-expression than the children are.
Lynn says that to raise healthy, creative, curious, thinking children, we need to give them the experience of conjuring something out of nothing. We need to provide them opportunities to truly interact with the world.
It's really important to remember that make-believe, that creative play, is absolutely essential to the health and well-being of children. It's the foundation of learning. It's key to school success. It's central to creativity and to the ability to make meaning of life.
She says parents need to take responsibility for making thoughtful choices about introducing children to the market-driven media at such young ages. But parents need help from educators, healthcare professionals, and mental health professionals as well. Lynn feels the public health community needs to take a stronger stance against advertising to children and start lobbying for better policies to keep marketers away from children's TV programs and develop parent education programs.
There is an obstacle to these organizations becoming more involved, and that is that many of them take funding from corporations or a partnership with corporations who have a vested interest in making sure that we don't have government policies.
For more information, go to commercialfreechildhood.org.
Earlier this year at the TED Conference, an annual invitation-only gathering of luminaries from the fields of technology, entertainment, and design, Alyssa Miller of Public Radio International gave a presentation about why the U.S. media is showing less of the world than ever before. She started off with statistics for the news coverage for February of 2007.
This was a month when North Korea agreed to dismantle its nuclear facilities. There was massive flooding in Indonesia. And in Paris, the IPCC released its study confirming man's impact on global warming. The U.S. accounted for 79% of total news coverage. And when we take out the U.S. and look at the remaining 21%, we see a lot of Iraq and little else. The combined coverage of Russia, China, and India, for example, reached just 1%. So why don't we hear more about the world? One reason is that news networks have reduced the number of their foreign bureaus by half. Aside from one-person ABC mini-bureaus in Nairobi, New Delhi, and Mumbai, there are no network news bureaus in all of Africa, India, or South America, places that are home to more than 2 billion people. The reality is that covering Britney is cheaper. And this lack of global coverage is all the more disturbing when we see where people go for news. Last year, Pew and the Columbia J School analyzed the 14,000 stories that appeared on Google News' front page, and they in fact covered the same 24 news events. Similarly, a study in e-content showed that much of global news from U.S. news creators is recycled stories from the AP wire services and Reuters, and don't put things into a context that people can understand their connection to it. In recent years, Americans who say they closely follow global news most of the time grew to over 50%. The real question, is this distorted worldview what we want for Americans in our increasingly interconnected world.
To see the video of Alyssa Miller's presentation, go to TED.com.
You've been listening to Media Minutes, a production of Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization working to reform the media. For more information, visit freepress.net.
Okay, and just remember, you can hear Media Minutes every week on Naked Lunch Radio at around 6:25, 6:30, and I'm not terribly anal retentive about start times, basically, however it works out. We do have about 29 more minutes of Naked Lunch Radio still to come with yours truly, Dean Farrell, here on WHUS. We're going to move on now to Counterpunch.org and a recent article by Michael Newman titled, Proportion and Distortion, Russia and Georgia. It said that Russia's response to Georgia's attack on South Ossetia is disproportionate. We hear of Western leaders anxiously watching for a withdrawal and puzzling over how to punish Moscow for what they call a disproportionate reaction to the Georgian offensive. No one has asked whether a disproportionate reaction or response is always wrong. War, or an armed attack, can itself be a disproportionate response to some offense. If Britain, for example, declared war on Sweden for producing ABBA, that would be disproportionate. Oh, I don't know. Anyway, it would also be wrong because ABBA isn't cause enough for initiating violence. Again, I don't know. Especially with that damn movie of theirs out. Anyway, back to the article. Britain could at least ask for a large indemnity first. The Nuremberg tribunals placed aggression, a crime against peace, ahead of war crimes. Perhaps this was meant to remind us that wars usher in far worse than war-fevered cheerleaders suppose and are virtually always an immoral and disproportionate response to offenses. Within a war, there are war crimes. Those aren't disproportionate responses, but responses directed against the wrong people or sometimes the wrong sort of response. Though it is not always wrong to kill innocent civilians, for example, killing a civilian if there were no other way to fend off a Nazi world conquest wouldn't be wrong, it is wrong to do so when you don't have to. Then your response is against the wrong people. You can also, within a war, make the wrong sort of response against the right people. You can certainly use force against an enemy soldier, but you can't torture the guy just because you're pissed off. There's also a relationship between war as an immorally disproportionate response or starting wars for the wrong reasons and all its consequences. When you start a war for the wrong reasons, you're responsible for all that follows, even the other side's atrocities. You don't even have the right to kill in self-defense. If you're wrong to start a war, you don't suddenly fall into the right just because, contrary to your expectations, it's you and not the other guy who has to defend himself. Georgia started a war, nothing less. The not terribly pro-Russian news agency Fox described the assault as follows. Georgia, a U.S. ally whose troops have been trained by American soldiers, launched a major offensive overnight Friday. Heavy rocket and artillery fire pounded the provincial capital, Skhinvali, leaving much of the city in ruins. One might add that Skhinvali's population was given no chance to evacuate. This was not a mere demonstration or a hit-or-run operation. This is starting a war. Georgia was not already at war with South Ossetia or anyone else because of a 1992 peace agreement. Here's a summary of the agreement from another not notably pro-Russian source, the U.S. State Department. The June 24, 1992 Sochi Agreement, again, I'm guessing at the pronunciation, it's spelled S-O-C-H-I, established a ceasefire between the Georgian and South Ossetian forces and defined both a zone of conflict around the South Ossetian capital of Skhinvali and a security corridor along the border of South Ossetian territories. The agreement also created the Joint Control Commission and a peacekeeping body, the Joint Peacekeeping Forces Group. The JPKF is under Russian command and is composed of peacekeepers from Georgia, Russia, and Russia's North Ossetian Autonomous Republic, as the separatist South Ossetian government remained unrecognized. South Ossetian peacekeepers, however, serve in the North Ossetian contingent. The Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe agreed to monitor the ceasefire and facilitate negotiations. Given the phrase security corridor along the border of the South Ossetian territories, the current conflict can't be seen as a mere recurrence of civil unrest. There was a line determined by international agreement, and Russia was in charge of keeping that line between the opposing forces. Russia, therefore, was authorized to see that no one crossed that line. It did not suddenly insinuate itself into a civil conflict. It had an internationally recognized mandate to be there and to maintain the security corridor. Since by the terms of this agreement, by explicit declaration and as a matter of blindingly obvious fact, Russia was committed to the defense of South Ossetia, Georgia did not just start a war with South Ossetia. It started one with Russia, too. The Georgians virtually proved, by killing Russian peacekeepers, that they understood this. If they didn't, then it just shows that they're stupid, not that they didn't start a war. It takes a lot to justify starting a war. Perhaps if another country is denying you resources without which you'll starve to death or is moving a large army toward your frontier. Some artillery exchanges are not enough, nor are territorial claims. Spain may have good territorial claims to Gibraltar, but that wouldn't justify starting a war with the UK. An adolescent country wanting to keep a province it doesn't need, assigned it by a universally despised dictator whose population desperately wants independence? That's not even a good territorial claim, much less sufficient reason for warfare. So Georgia not only started a war, it started one without sufficient reason. Commentators manage not to grasp that this is a huge deal, probably because they're prejudiced against Russia to the point of incoherence. Suppose that all the accusations against Russia are true. Maybe Russia wanted a war and provoked Georgia. Maybe Russia wants to extend its influence. Russia did kill innocent civilians when it bombed Gori. It went far beyond what was necessary to repel an invasion. Georgia was an internationally recognized sovereign state. Technically, it may not have been an aggressor. It was attacking territory to which it had a formally plausible claim, contested by no other sovereign state. It probably killed fewer South Ossetian civilians than originally supposed. Some South Ossetians killed innocent civilians and engaged in ethnic cleansing. Russia destroyed a lot of stuff after the fighting died down. Maybe Russia resents the freedom-loving propensities of tiny, plucky Georgia. None of this makes any difference. Russia was still in the right and Georgia in the wrong. The civilian casualties inflicted by Russian aviation were, by all reports, genuine collateral damage. And recent history makes it abundantly clear that the international community finds such killing entirely acceptable. Yet, some Russians or South Ossetians no doubt committed atrocities, and the atrocities of this and every other war are inexcusable. But if the individuals involved are responsible for their acts, responsibility at the state level rests almost entirely with Georgia, which knew perfectly well what war would bring, and for Russia to meet warfare with warfare was fully justified. Whether or not Georgia's attack was a real threat to Russia can be debated back and forth. Certainly, Georgia itself was no threat. But it has been clear for over a decade that the West is out to encircle Russia with NATO allies, armed to the teeth and backed by nuclear weapons. Not to respond to an attack by a devoted fan of the US and NATO would have given this process a green light. It would have also encouraged more violent separatism within Russia's boundaries. Maybe if Russia had not fought back, there would have been much greater violence later on. No one can know for sure. But we don't need to know. When someone whose existence you don't threaten starts a war with you, you can fight back. It's that simple. All that remains is the question with which we started. Was the Russian response disproportionate? Maybe. But disproportionate responses in warfare are absolutely standard and quite acceptable. This is apparent in any battlefield scenario. Assuming you didn't start the war in the first place, you don't have to tread lightly. No one supposes that if you calculate you can win by destroying one-tenth of the enemy's forces, that's all you're allowed to do. Wiping out its whole army is perfectly okay. Barring a formal surrender, you can go on to destroy all the military targets you can find, and most strategic ones as well, even if this means some collateral damage. When the Allies are faulted for what they did to Germany or Japan, the criticism is always about actions that are said to go well beyond such limits, like the bombings of Dresden, Hiroshima, and Nagasaki. War is not like self-defense in civilian life, when the response must be proportionate to the threat. In civilian life, the expectation is that there are authorities who will sort the whole business out. In war, there is no such expectation. If you've been attacked, you do not have to trust in the feeble prospect that perhaps the international community will make everything okay. You're entitled to make damn good and sure that your enemy will never attack you again. You would be a fool not to do so, at least when your enemy has proven to be a murderous idiot under the patronage of the world's strongest military power. The unacceptably disproportionate response was Georgia's in starting the war, not Russia's in finishing it. Michael Newman is a professor of philosophy at Trent University in Ontario, Canada. It's 20 minutes to 7, and you're listening to Naked Lunch Radio on WHUS 91.7 FM. I'm your host and producer, Dean Farrell, and I am completely responsible for the content of this show. Let me see what I have with me. Okay, this is by Paul Craig Roberts of opednews.com, and it's titled, "Are You Ready for Nuclear War?" That's a rhetorical question, by the way. You don't have to answer it. Pervez Musharraf, the puppet installed by the U.S. to rule Pakistan in the interest of U.S. hegemony, resigned August 18th to avoid impeachment. Karl Rove and the Diebold electronic voting machines were unable to control the result of the last election in Pakistan, the result of which gave Pakistanis a bigger voice in their government than Americans have in theirs. It was obvious to anyone with any sense, which excludes the entire Bush regime and almost the entire foreign policy community, that the illegal and gratuitous U.S. invasions of Afghanistan and Iraq and Israel's 2006 bombing of Lebanon civilians with U.S. blessing would result in the overthrow of America's Pakistani puppet. The imbecilic Bush regime ensured Musharraf's overthrow by pressuring their puppet to conduct military operations against tribesmen in Pakistani border areas whose loyalties were to fellow Muslims and not to American hegemony. When Musharraf's military operations didn't produce the desired result, the idiotic Americans began conducting their own military operations within Pakistan with bombs and missiles. That finished off Musharraf. When the Bush regime began its wars in the Middle East, I predicted correctly that Musharraf would be one victim. The American puppets in Egypt and Jordan may be the next to go. Back during the Nixon years, my PhD dissertation chairman, Warren Nutter, was Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Affairs. One day in his Pentagon office, I asked him how the U.S. got foreign governments to do what the U.S. wanted. He replied, "Money." I asked, "You mean foreign aid?" He said, "No, we just buy the leaders with money." It wasn't a policy he had implemented. He inherited it, and although the policy rankled with him, he could do nothing about it. Nutter believed in persuasion, and that if you could not persuade people, you did not have a policy. Nutter did not mean merely that third world potentates were bought. He meant the leaders of England, France, Germany, Italy, and all the allies everywhere were bought and paid for. They were allies because they were paid. Consider Tony Blair. Blair's own head of British intelligence told him that the Americans were fabricating the evidence to justify their already planned attack on Iraq. That was fine with Blair, and you can see why with his multi-million dollar payoff since he left office. The American-educated thug, Saakashvili, the war criminal, who was president of Georgia, was installed by the U.S. taxpayer-funded National Endowment for Democracy, a neocon operation whose purpose is to ring Russia with U.S. military bases so that America can exert hegemony over Russia. Every agreement that President Reagan made with Mikhail Gorbachev has been broken by Reagan's successor. Reagan's was the last American government whose foreign policy was not made by Israeli-allied neoconservatives. During the Reagan years, the neocons made several runs at it, but each ended in disaster for Reagan, and eventually he drove the modern-day French Jacobins from his government. Even the Anti-Soviet Committee on the Present Danger regarded the neocons as dangerous lunatics. I remember meeting when a member tried to bring the neocons into the committee, and old-line American establishment representatives such as Foreign Treasury Secretary Douglas Dillon hit the roof. The Committee on the Present Danger regarded the neocons as crazy people who would get America into a nuclear war with the Soviet Union. The neocons hated Reagan because he ended the Cold War with diplomacy when they desired a military victory over the Soviets. Deprived of this, the neocons now want victory over Russia. Today, Reagan is gone. The Republican establishment is gone. There are no conservative power centers, only neocon power centers closely allied with Israel, which uses the billions of dollars funneled into Israeli coffers by U.S. taxpayers to influence U.S. elections and foreign policy. The Republican candidate for president is a warmonger. There are no checks remaining in the Republican Party on the neocons' proclivity for war. What Republican constituencies oppose war? Can anybody name one? The Democrats aren't much better, but they have some constituencies that are not enamored of war in order to establish U.S. world hegemony. The rapture evangelicals, who fervently desire Armageddon, are not Democrats, nor are the brainwashed brown shirts desperate to vent their frustrations by striking at someone, somewhere, anywhere. I get emails from these brown shirts and attest that their hate-filled ignorance is extraordinary. They're all Republicans, and yet they think they're conservatives. They have no idea who I am, but since I criticize the Bush regime and America's belligerent foreign policy, I'm obviously, in their eyes, a liberal commie pinko. The only literate sentence this legion of imbeciles has ever imagined is this: if you hate America so much, why don't you move to Cuba? Such is the current state of a Reagan political appointee in today's Republican Party. He's a liberal commie pinko who should move to Cuba. The Republicans will get us into more wars. Indeed, they live for war. McCain is preaching war for 100 years. For these warmongers, it is like cheering for your home team. Win at all costs. They get a vicarious pleasure out of war. If the U.S. has to tell lies in order to attack countries, what's wrong with that? If we don't kill them over there, they'll kill us over here. The mindlessness is total. Nothing real issues from the American media. The media are about demonizing Russia and Iran, about the vice presidential choices, as if it matters, about whether Obama being on vacation let McCain score too many points. The mindlessness of the news reflects the mindlessness of the government, for which it is a spokesperson. The American media do not serve American democracy or American interests. They serve the few people who exercise power. When the Soviet Union collapsed, the U.S. and Israel made a run at controlling Russia and the former constituent parts of its empire. For a while, the U.S. and Israel succeeded, but Putin put a stop to it. Recognizing that the U.S. had no intention of keeping any of the agreements it had made with Gorbachev, Putin directed the Russian military budget to upgrade the Russian nuclear deterrent. Consequently, the Russian army and air force lack the smart weapons and electronics of the U.S. military. When the Russian army went into Georgia to rescue the Russians in South Ossetia from the destruction being inflicted upon them by the American puppet Saakashvili, the Russians made it clear that if they were opposed by American troops with smart weapons, they would deal with the threat with tactical nuclear weapons. The Americans were the first to announce preemptive nuclear attack as if their permissible war doctrine. Now the Russians have announced the tactical use of nuclear weapons as their response to American smart weapons. It is obvious that American foreign policy, with its goal of wringing Russia with U.S. military bases, is leading directly to nuclear war. Every American needs to realize this fact. The U.S. government's insane hegemonic foreign policy is a direct threat to life on the planet. Russia has made no threats against America. The post-Soviet Russian government has sought to cooperate with the U.S. and Europe. Russia has made it clear over and over that it's prepared to obey international law and treaties. It's the Americans who have thrown international law and treaties into the trash can, not the Russians. In order to keep the billions of dollars in profits flowing to its contributors in the U.S. military security complex, the Bush regime has rekindled the Cold War. As American living standards decline and the prospects for university graduates deteriorate, our, quote-unquote, leaders in Washington commit us to 100 years of war. If you desire to be poor, oppressed, and eventually vaporized in a nuclear war, vote Republican. Paul Craig Roberts, a former Assistant Secretary of the U.S. Treasury and former Associate Editor of the Wall Street Journal, has held numerous academic appointments. He has been reporting shocking cases of prosecutorial abuse for 2 decades. And we have about 10 minutes still to come on this week's edition of Naked Lunch Radio here at WHUS with yours truly, Dean Farrell. This next article is a bit of satire that comes from Joel Hirshhorn's DelusionalDemocracy.com. The final results are in on this historic November day. Despite the hundreds of millions of dollars he raised, Barack Obama has lost the 2008 presidential election. American voters have boldly spoken truth to arrogance. Turned out that all those pre-election opinion polls that showed Obama's inability to get over 50% support were prescient. Much of the public was never comfortable with Obama, though he clearly was so comfortable acting like he was already president. Hillary and Bill Clinton are probably drinking champagne and having the sweetest time since Bill won his first presidential election. Hillary must now bite her lip repeatedly and resist saying publicly, "I told you so." Hillary in 2012 will reveal that she learned her lessons well. All that Obama audacity of arrogance from the smiling, glib politician finally died the death it so richly deserved. Too many pundits will blame his loss on his blackness and on racist voters. But the larger truth is that sufficient voters saw through the many lies and deceptions. Obama has always had a hard time giving a simple, short, straight answer to tough questions. He was always mentally calculating exactly how to game his answers so that he would achieve all the benefits he had his eyes on. He was simply too damn presumptuous and too damn smart for his own good. In the end, Americans did not want the smartest person in the presidency, or endless nuancing. They want someone they can easily understand and trust, despite their skepticism. There were many reasons not to trust the calculating Obama to do anything he promised to do, or for some people, to fear that he might. The bloviating pundits will also blame third-party presidential candidates for siphoning votes from Obama. As if Americans have no right to exercise their political freedom and vote for someone they honestly think has the best policy positions and would most help restore American democracy. Jon Stewart and other late-night comics will feast on these election results, as they should. I can't wait to hear jokes about Obama's wife becoming a more vocal and militant critic of the good old U.S. of A., now that she has proof positive that so many Americans are stupid white racists. Of course, now the nation must suffer through the ineptness, confusion, and dementia-like dullness of the living-in-the-past John McCain. Tough-talking, but brain-dead. Will the McCain presidency look like an extension of the incredibly terrible George W. Bush White House? Of course it will. Still living off a once-true characterization as a maverick, McCain must now surround himself with people who actually are smart and knowledgeable about myriad issues. Should be no problem finding enough lobbyists. Pundits will start speculating that McCain will be lucky just to stay alive for 4 years, but thankfully his vice president seems more capable. One thing's for sure, the power plutocracy that really runs the country will have little trouble pulling the strings behind the scenes and keeping the puppet McCain dancing to tunes written by corporate interests. Ralph Nader summed it up this way. A large fraction of Americans know that we need a Jeffersonian political revolution to fix our corrupt system. They were not fooled by the Obama rhetoric about change, not from someone that has been a product of and servant for the two-party plutocracy. Our voters correctly protested against the corrupt two-party system. They did not elect McCain. Only those who voted for McCain elected him, and that is something they must live with as they watch a McCain administration continue dismantling American democracy and budget-busting global warmongering. Cynthia McKinney wisely noted that it is time to stop saying God bless America and begin repeating God save America. The good news is that we will build even greater public support for a true national political revolution during the McCain presidency. All too often, things must get much worse before they get better. They will get worse. As to Obama, he half-jokingly said, "I may come back as a third-party candidate." Or did that reflect a calculation that Democrats had learned their lesson? As to all the screaming from the left that the Republicans stole this election too, Obama immediately said, "John won it fair and square." Thanks, Barack. That's exactly what I expected from a fake agent for change.
And tomorrow when you get back to work, work hard like you always have.
Aw, man, come on, people. You gotta stop falling for that propaganda. They spreading that we're free propaganda. Free to do what? Work hard and ensure that corporate monopolies stay wealthy, consume their goods. Free to spend our money on products made by the hands of other oppressed people who weren't fairly compensated for their labor. Free to ignore genocides in Africa. Free to get pepper sprayed and arrested when we protest the unjust war for oil in Iraq, funded with our tax dollars. Free to close our eyes, vacation, and ignore the world's struggles. Supposedly, others are jealous. Jealous of our liberty, jealous of our democratic ways. But as long as we live in Babylon, in the belly of the beast, in a country that occupies the Middle East, in this imperialist, fascist, racist, classist, Patriot Act having dictator supporting poverty ignoring country that has its dirty hand in Africa, South America, Asia, and the Caribbean, and the rest of the world, then we owe it to the rest of the world. In the spirit of Martin Luther King, Malcolm X, and the Moomba, Che Guevara, and my sister's baby girls, and so many more, including ourselves, to continue to fight and organize for a better tomorrow, for positive social change. Cause guess what, America? Social justice is a moral issue. Poverty is a moral issue. So let's get it together. Let's do this together. We need to build a foundation. Iraq, big op.
Until Asada receives amnesty, until Mumia feels the ocean breeze and gets to see his family, to millions are released from wrongful incarceration, from modern day plantations to self-determination, to black sea reparations for the works of generations, blood, sweat and tears that built this damn nation. I want our government to swallow its pride and apologize, admit to genocide and cut its ties to corporate lies, till we win the war on poverty, acknowledge its atrocities. It's how it ought to be if this is a real democracy, till everyone who needs it receives welfare, and every man, woman and child receives healthcare, till every human being has rose from the misery, and we begin to teach our children their real history, till white America acknowledges classism, deals with racism and fights the fascism, till the Christian right wing learns to be more Christian. If Jesus were here now, they'd put him in prison, call him a hippie and hit him and then question his vision, till Muslims in America can practice their religion without being scared of some bigoted politicians, till we never hear the words nigger or spick, that goes for everyone including off my own people's lips, till Murdoch and Falk start telling the truth, and we stop selling guns that are killing our youth, till these rappers stop spitting bullshit in the booth and support our troops. It's more than just a slogan, and we honor diversity and not just hiring tokens, till the Cuban embargo is halted and the young lords, Black Panthers and Mau Maus are exalted, till we treat every immigrant with respect and not look down upon them for speaking their dialects, till the troops stop coming home in coffins, till they decide against the Biolab 4 building in Boston and the war on drugs and start rehabilitating, stand with Palestine and end the occupation, till we have more choices for president instead of two clones, except one was a little more intelligent, when cops stop mistaking guns for wallets in your pocket, and when Nike, McDonald's and Starbucks don't make a profit, till there's no more domestic violence fatalities, and pigs do jail time for police brutality, till P. Diddy and friends stop using sweatshops and Viacom and Fair Channel play real hip hop, till we stop the blind patriotic loyalty, treat our elders with compassion as if they were royalty, till want and self-determination is not sedition, and the good old boy network stops being tradition. If we're not at the table, then we're on the menu, until women get paid the same as men do, till people really care and they just don't pretend to, when a 10-year-old with a gun can't just up and end you, till Puerto Rico has its own independence and Donald Trump gets slapped right on The Apprentice, till we teach our children that in their dreams they should believe in true happiness only comes with love and not greed, till we destroy the WTO and IMF and punish the CIA for MLK's death, till we stop glorifying the founding fathers when they had slaves that they traded and bartered, till Ron Brown's killers are searched for and found and the Confederate flag is burned to the ground, till we end generations of segregation and spend more money on our children's education, till white privilege is for the whole population and even progressives learn to deal with gentrification, till every vote counts and elections aren't stolen, till every news channel stops the damn polling, till we end the death penalty in every state, and there's no more leaders that tell us to wait, till there's no more overpricing prescription drugs, and people care less if two women fall in love, when we stop funding the military industrial complex and stop lusting over their material objects, till we fund a dream and take over DC, and when Cheney and Halliburton don't sit as VP, until they release the cure for my mom's cancer and stop using 9/11 as propaganda, when we're told the truth about that day in September, never again, rest in peace, believe me, we'll remember when we choose to learn from our martyrs' wisdom, yes, and rise up against U.S. imperialism, when we don't use band-aids on bullet wounds that are bleeding, maybe then we'll really have freedom, maybe then we'll really be free, and if you believe, put your fist in the air and pump it with me, dedicated to the freedom fighters, teachers, organizers, activists, blue-collar workers all over America, to the unions that rattle cages to lift the minimum wages, family surviving all over the world, all my brothers locked up and working the block surviving, Don Pedro Albizu Campos, Casi Torre, Presente, the free in ourselves, crew, the sisters are reflecting strength in my peoples at Leftist Lounge, SJE, Critical Breakdown, Everett Hoagland, Askia Torre, Amiri Baraka, the last poets, P.E.D.P., Fred Hampton Jr., Sonia Sanchez, Martin Espada, David D., Lady Lex, Nisreen, VCR, Warrior, Justin, Waleed, Bamboo, the Durock Club, Fife and Rue, my brother from another mother, Optimus, and all the world's revolutionaries. To the memory of Marianne Perez and JoJo Turner, we fight on. From Boston to PR to Liberia to Saigon. Peace, love, and blessings. Uprise, Amandla. All power to the people. All power. All
right, there's some Rasta man who would denounce using the fruits of Babylon, so to speak, to build up any kind of organization.
The fruits of Babylon. Babylon.
and with Foundation Movement giving us Fruits of Babylon, we come to the end of this week's Naked Lunch Radio. And I just wanted to remind you that any opinions you might hear expressed on this show, whether by me or by the writers I read, do not necessarily reflect the views of the staff, management, or licensee of WHUS. This is Dean Farrell, and if you'd like to touch base with me, your best bet would be by email. My address is nakedlunchradio@hotmail.com. Wanted to remind you again, podcasts of Naked Lunch Radio are now available if you go to radioforall.net. Again, that's radio, the number 4all.net, and just type Naked Lunch Radio into their on-site search engine. This is Dean Farrell inviting you to stick around for UConn Men's Soccer coming up in just a couple of minutes. This is 91.7 FM, WHUS, Storrs, Connecticut, UConn's radio for the people. We'll be right back.